Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show, Bill Russell and Iris Chang. We're just talking about the Manchu heritage and the fact that, in fact, being Chinese made a difference.
Well, and being the education was...
was definitely revered, but that there are cultural reasons for that. During the Qing Dynasty, the majority of the Chinese people, the Han people, were actually oppressed by an ethnic minority, the Manchus. And one of the things that the Manchus did to encourage the subjugation was to refine the imperial exam system, which is that your fate... If you had ambitions in government service or to become an official, was determined by a series of tests. And of course, this is one reason why many of the Chinese have always revered education. It was often the key to success, but it was also a tool of social control. It didn't necessarily encourage creativity at that time, and it enabled the government to try to channel that passion and energy of youth into just, you know, studying the old classics and determining the scope of the education of the people who would be working in the bureaucracy.
I've always thought of that as, you know, essentially the bureaucracy and the way that happened as being more or less Confucian. And what I'm hearing you say, and I think I read, is it's sort of Confucian, but it's also a distortion, a perversion.
It was a form of political control. And China, with its long, you know, 5,000-year history, has gone through so many different cycles of either social control or sometimes great openness. There were other times when creativity was permitted to blossom. And, you know, I mean, I think there's now more evidence that it was the Chinese, really, who may have discovered North America. And there were these great expeditions that the Chinese had sent out in previous eras where they really did encourage, you know, technological development, and when you look at some of the innovations that have come out of China, you know, paper, gunpowder, printing, there were certainly times where their people were permitted to develop and grow and to innovate, and then there were other times when that would just shut down and the government would become extraordinarily controlling and selfish and would want to freeze society as it was. And during the period of the Qing Dynasty, as my book begins, immigration out of China was actually illegal at that time. They really shut down those. They wanted, you know, the migration outward, but it happened despite their attempts to try to contain it. There was in fact a global diaspora of Chinese at that time,
which had an enormous impact on the world as well as China, as well as the people who left.
That's right. Now the Chinese in America, my third book, is just really a story of a small fraction of that immigration experience. I mean, but the Chinese have gone to other countries, and sometimes as a group they've done much better than even the Chinese in this country. For example, in Southeast Asia, all of the billionaires are ethnic Chinese.
That will be billionaires.
Billionaires with a B, that's right. They wield enormous economic power there. They are some of the wealthiest people in the world. But what's interesting, though, is that periodically there are pogroms against the Chinese communities. It's very similar almost like to the Jewish experience in Germany. And I've seen that the Chinese experience has parallels with a lot of other ethnic groups because of the economic functions they have. Now, the Chinese, like the Jews, the Armenians, and the Lebanese, are the four great middlemen minority groups in the world. And so they actually have a lot of similarities in their experiences. They tend to come into a country with reverence for education, often with certain habits of frugality and entrepreneurial energies, and what they'll often do is they'll bring a capitalist function into regions that are often feudal in nature. But as middlemen, they will facilitate the flow of goods between producers and consumers. And so they've often created industries from the ground up. And when times are prosperous, often they will be highly successful. But whenever there's an economic or political crisis, these middlemen minorities are often the first groups to be blamed for everything, and then they are scapegoated and often even targeted for genocide.
Well, and this is going on, I'm trying to think of the list. Malaysia has had problems with that. Singapore, I think, has had problems with that. Indonesia has had problems with that. America's had problems with that. But this is an ongoing phenomenon.
beyond just the Chinese population. Well,
absolutely. But as you describe it, particularly in that part of the world, you know, the Chinese have been targeted repeatedly for their roles and for being Chinese. And it's not just the rich Chinese. It is anyone who happens to be Chinese. Mm-hmm. It's still, this all seems like history. And I want to... You know, you tell some stories about the Chinese, American Chinese, many of whom have been here for much longer than...
Generations.
Mm-hmm.
In the 90s, and even into the... after the turn of the century, still substantive discriminatory behaviors at the highest levels of state, local, and federal government.
Good old-fashioned discrimination.
There's no question of that.
But, you know,
sometimes it couldn't work for a public corporation or even testify against white people in court.
But in tell us some of those stories about the 90s.
The 1990s.
Oh, the 1990s.
Yeah, I'm not talking about...
This is current.
The backlash against the Chinese-American population. I was very alarmed to see that... With the end of the Cold War and the demise of the Soviet Union, there seemed to be a real buildup, you know, in our military-industrial complex to try to frame China as, like, our new enemy.
Well, we have to have an enemy. Otherwise, we don't need a military-industrial complex.
You know? And it just became very clear, you know, in the 1990s that China was slated as that enemy, and that, you know, we started seeing movies like Red Corner and, you know, 7 Years in Tibet. But more disturbingly, you would see in Time magazine, on the cover of Time magazine, you know, questions like the new Cold War, you know, wondering if China had been spying on this country for generations, and on the basis of some very flimsy evidence, there was that Cox report on alleged Chinese espionage. And my first book is about how a brilliant professor at Caltech, a Chinese immigrant, was falsely accused of being a communist and then deported to China, where he became the father of the, you know, the PRC missile program. That was in the 1950s. The Cox report was trying to claim that CN was a spy. They were using my book as a source, but they were also, they really distorted a lot of facts and also claimed that that CN was a spy. I called them up and asked, what evidence do you have? I researched this book for 3 years. I never found evidence it was a spy, but if you have evidence, let me see it. They said, well, you'll just have to trust us on this. They said, whatever we have is classified, so you'll just have to take our word for it. But they didn't have any evidence that they produced. So there was that buildup. The Wenho Li case is an example of this backlash where that Los Alamos physicist, a Chinese American, was then, accused of espionage and
kept in solitary confinement,
and
treated miserably.
Eventually, the judge had to apologize to him. This was a lot like the Wenho Li case of the 1990s was a lot like the Tian Hushen case of the 1950s, which is the subject of my first book, Threat of the Silkworm, because Tian eventually became the father of the Silkworm missile. And it just goes to show that sometimes all of these paranoid methods to try to promote or to preserve our national security could have often the opposite effect by driving out or forcing out some of the most brilliant people in this country to other countries. But then, you know, all of a sudden this backlash against the Chinese disappeared when a new enemy was found. After 9/11, all of a sudden the emphasis shifted to the Middle East.
So it's okay to be Chinese American now?
Yeah, but I have to say that every time you have a new target or scapegoat, the laws that are passed to hurt that group are going to affect all of us. In fact, I mean, you know, the Karamatsu case, the case that challenged Japanese-American internment, you know, did not win in the Supreme Court years ago. And so that's still very much on the books and could be used to intern people now, if possible. So, I mean, that's why I think we have to be ever vigilant to study what's being done to other minority groups, however unpopular they might be at a given moment.
You also talk about education and the tendency to, scapegoat Chinese Americans, Chinese and Chinese Americans in the educational environment, particularly in higher education, and some what to me were very surprising numbers. Tell me about higher education.
are we talking then about some? There have been a lot of allegations that Chinese Americans have faced systematic discrimination. That the more they achieved, the higher the bar was raised.
Well, the argument was, you know, there were entirely too many Chinese going to Berkeley.
That was the subject of a huge controversy just a few years ago, and we had people who. With perfect, you know, SAT scores. And
that would be perfect.
Perfect, and 4.0 GPAs being turned away while others who had not even filled out their applications fully were being admitted. It was a horrible situation. And it's also interesting, too, when you look at the data of the kinds of educational returns that Chinese Americans or other Asian Americans have often received, the financial returns or the career returns on their education, it is not on the same level as that of often the general public or the Caucasian population.
Well, you also talk about the particularly in the science and the corporate environment, the
bamboo ceiling.
Yeah, and I worked in California for a while, and like everybody else, I assumed that Chinese didn't want to manage people because that's what I was told.
That was the perception that many Chinese Americans had to face as they worked for large corporations. They may have, many of them are highly educated. They have their doctorates, and they were eager for leadership roles. But then they ran into that model minority myth, which is that. They were the technical brains of the company, but they didn't really want to be leaders, and that they were going to be docile, like teacher's pets, and just do all the work and maybe not get all the rewards. And there were groups that then organized to protest this. I think at AT&T they had an organization really to fight against this, and there were other attempts by Chinese Americans to speak out, and I think that many of them are discovering that often the only way to completely rid themselves of the bamboo curtain is to just go and take the entrepreneurial route.
This is Iris Chang. We'll have a couple more minutes with her when we return in a moment with the Paula Gordon Show. Please do be with us.